Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as exploring the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. I'm here today with Eddie Morton from Lift Orlando, a nonprofit business and collection of community leaders who work together to close the gap created by underinvestment for children and families in communities around Orlando. Welcome, Eddie, and thanks for your time here with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me start off and let's get to know you a little bit. Can you give us a little background of yourself?
Sure. Thank you. Born in D.C., was there till about 8 or 10 years old when my family moved to Puerto Rico. My parents divorced at a young age, and during that time, experienced a lot of need, and my mom found out she had distant relatives that lived on that island, though our family was born in the Dominican Republic, and my parents grew up in D.C. And so living there, she eventually remarried a young entrepreneur, and seeing the world through his eyes, the impact that it had actually on our own family to not only not be living in public housing or indulging in public subsidies that we needed, but finding ourselves at the receiving end of opportunity where we were not only traveling and living in a home and having nice cars, but watching him provide for other families and how hard he worked to create opportunities for the many households that were provided and supported through this small business. It started when he was still in high school. And so that, to me, gave me my first taste of the power of even a small business. Moved to Orlando and really gave my life to Christ and started a personal journey of faith that led me to ministry, and thought that's what I was going to do the rest of my life, was working in a small inner city church, mostly helping young men coming out of gangs and drug addiction and in some cases violent lifestyles to begin to discover opportunity for them and their families. And that was addictive, just to see life transformation up close. But was bivocational. I found myself working at the Chamber of Commerce, starting out there, eventually becoming Director of Membership Services, supporting a lot of major events. Back then, the Chamber was sort of the hub of the business community. And so I was Director of the Small Business Chamber for Membership Services, and Jacob Stewart was President of the organization, who took me under his wing and served as a great role model for me. But I remember going into meetings, and it's like, you know, Glenda Hood is mayor, and Tom Yoakum is over at Sun Bank, and there's these all these incredible leaders. But I noticed real quickly that these handful of leaders were making decisions that were impacting millions of people in our community. And both the burden and privilege of people who have the ability to do that opened my eyes, being so familiar with the dark underbelly of the same city I love, that there is a role for people in business that must be taken great responsibility for the power and impact it can have, more than nonprofit leaders can, more than even our elected officials often can have, but that independent business sector influence is critical in community health. That captured my mind. In the years that followed, I was there for a while before entering the world of consulting and workforce development and leadership development work, and then started our first company in 2006 after marrying my wife. And that really was about creating peer advisory groups for CEOs and doing development for leaders, and did a lot of that work here and in Washington, D.C. And then prior to Lift was that LifeWork Leadership, a leadership development program here in town, had a great meaning in my life. And a lot of the companies that were patrons in that work, we began to collide around this idea that maybe there should be a different role for the downtown business community and major employers to play in transforming the realities on the other side of those quintessential railroad tracks downtown. And that began the journey for Lift.
So I got to admit, we've known each other, I don't know, is it 10, 15 years? And clearly I know you, but even in that 3 minutes, hearing some of your upbringing, I'm shocked that I didn't know that. So I appreciate you sharing, and a great reminder of, oh my gosh, hearing people's story is so important. All right, so saying that, if you were to describe who Eddie Morton is today, how would you describe that?
You know, my for 20 years, I've had this personal sense of, I describe it my life work. And so my mission sort of lived forward is to really inspire and equip leaders to make a difference in the marketplace. And I'm a leadership junkie in many ways, have dedicated myself to learning, reading, absorbing everything I can about it. But it's because I see my definition for leadership is taking on the burden of responsibility for the benefit of other people. And so seeing people in the marketplace understand that, that every benefit that comes of leadership is a form of privilege and responsibility that should be stewarded with gratitude, but also generosity. So that really is what makes my heart beat. In those days of the chamber, I struggled for a while with my faith and sort of professional vocation in that world of ministry and this appeal for the world of business and the marketplace and community in the business sector, and eventually realized that those two things didn't have to be mutually exclusive. And so today, whether it's nonprofit work we're doing now, whether it's been for-profit work in the past, whether it's community, philanthropic, private, public, whatever the hat may be, my mission is still the same. It's how do we equip people to make a difference in their community?
Okay, so first tell us where we are sitting right now.
Yeah, so I have the privilege of serving as the president for Lift Orlando. We're a nonprofit founded to really invest in the community of Westlakes, surrounding Camping World Stadium in the heart of the 32805 zip code. And so for folks that don't know Central Florida or Orlando, that's just west of downtown Orlando, about a mile from Main and Main in downtown Orlando, let's say the Performing Arts Center. And the zip code has sort of three chapters of African-American history in Orlando. The historically segregated part of Orlando, Paramore, as it's known, was a collection of neighborhoods segregated officially by our former mayor, James B. Paramore. That Paramore Avenue was named after him, and eventually the area became known for that name. On the far west side, past John Young, Washington Shores is one of the first Black suburbs in the country. Orlando, it's interesting, we have the oldest Black community here, Jonestown, which is on the site of Reeves Terrace and the Greenwood Cemetery on the east side of town, predates even Eatonville. But a lot of those folks were forced to relocate into what we now consider Paramore, Carver Shores, Holden Heights area, for Reeves Terrace to be built as public housing for only whites at first, and then for much lesser housing be built for Blacks. But in the 40s and 50s, something unique happened here, where Blacks and whites partnered to build across about 300 acres between Clear Lake and Lake Man to build Washington Shores with housing, schools, apartments, opportunities for home ownership, small businesses. But this investment on the west side, absentee slumlords that wouldn't care for property or the community, you saw a steady decline and the ravages of the 80s and 90s in inner cities around the country. And yet there is still a generation of people who have grown up here, who are in the homes their parents built, who are loyal to this community that we discovered. And so they'd been here all along, but they were news to me. I've been here since 1990 and didn't know that prior history. So we started Lift Orlando in a timeline that collided with the stadium being reinvested in with $200+ million. We thought, we don't even have a football team. Like, why are we building a new stadium? But the stadium had a mission to figure out how to use events for the benefit of the broader community. And they, like our founding group of partners, Tom Sidema, Bill Diamond, Harold Mills, and others, Terry Prather, who's on our staff, were suffering from what I describe as weary donor syndrome, right? Where they're writing checks, they're sponsoring stuff left and right, they're going to each other's rubber chicken dinners, but are they really moving the needle? And so we realized, to make a long story short, that what was absent in Central Florida was a significant investment in what's called place-based philanthropy, that because injustice and racial inequity in our country's history has been tied to certain geographies, to communities of color being choked off from opportunity and resources, if you really wanted to help families in permanent ways, you didn't just need more programs and services. You needed to reverse those effects. So today we drive investments in people, resident-led. You walking into our office, you met Tim Ayers. He leads Westlake's partnership, one of the organizations doing great work here in the community, led entirely by residents. We invest in place. So we're up to about $100 million now between two phases of housing, early learning programs, after-school programs, a new health and wellness center coming soon, a brand new city park. And we invest in partnerships. And so recruiting best-in-class nonprofit partners, philanthropic leaders, public, private sector, whoever wants to help lift up this community because you love Orlando and we should care for every child is who we try to work with in collaboration. So that gives you kind of maybe more than you asked for, but a big picture summary of what we do.
So I'm assuming this next question, you may have already answered it, but if not, I'll let you expand on it. You know, how are you all here or yourself trying to change the world? And would you just answer that, or is there more to add to that question?
I think there's something particular to America, maybe where we kind of think of this context. There's still a great shortage of initiatives that are thinking in large scale about investing in particular neighborhoods. And and reinforcing the strength of neighborhoods to be healthy ecosystems for families to thrive. And so a lot of cities now in post-tragedy and crisis are using the term like strong, Orlando strong, Tampa strong, you know, this, but the strength of the city really is determined by the strength of its neighborhoods. A city is only as strong as its most vulnerable neighborhoods. And so that idea of connecting the capital and growth and improvement and development of a city to how well our most vulnerable families are doing and identifying, measuring, and changing that at a neighborhood scale. The David Brooks is a writer for the New York Times. His little line, he titled an article by this once, is that neighborhoods should be the unit of change. Not people, not how many people you fed, but how many neighborhoods are now life-giving and places of hope and opportunity. That's what we'd like to see be the new MO for philanthropy, for public investment, for corporate social responsibility in America for the future.
When you say neighborhood, how is that different from the mantra that we need to fix the family or enrich the family? Same thing or different concept?
Different concept. I think the family is essential, but you have, when you think holistically, how do you create the environment for that family to thrive? So I can help you be a great dad, help you be a great mom, but if you're still, you're homeless and you're bouncing around from couch to couch with your kids and your school is not providing what your kids need to succeed and you can't find a better job to change any of those variables, all that has to do with the environment I put you in. And so what we learned early on is that there's a metaphor often used in the evolution of nonprofits that it's better to give a man, teach a man how to fish than to give a man a fish, right? And so when we studied the nonprofit community in Central Florida years ago, we found that 93% or so of our local charities were in some form of crisis relief, feeding, clothing, housing, helping people who were in a time of need. And the problem is 95% of our poor were not in crisis. There was no recent event, no hurricane, storm, earthquake that put them there. They were in chronic, often long-term, even generational poverty across our region. And that was concentrated. It wasn't generally distributed. It was concentrated in certain neighborhoods that had certain histories against them. Now, about 7% were in the category of what you might call betterment and development, training, giving people skills and tools to get a better job, make more money, stand on their own too. And that's that whole teaching a man how to fish. But when we looked at how to move the needle on entire populations of people doing better economically and in every other category, our four pillars are housing, education, health and wellness, and economic growth. The only places actually doing that successfully in America were had both figured out that you had to discover the connection between poverty and place. That chronic poverty was concentrated in certain places, not evenly distributed. And two, realize that the metaphor of fishing went further. So now the man or woman, they know how to fish. But do they own a fishing rod? Do they have the right bait? Do they have access to a pond? Has that pond been stocked or is it fenced off? That they are also beyond your will to succeed or your skills you might develop. There are environmental factors that either deter or accelerate your ability to be successful. And so in America today, that plays out. We're here in 32805 versus 32804. You cross Highway 50, you find yourself in College Park, the Country Club of Orlando. You might as well be in a different planet. And the amount of opportunities and resources and assumptions and expectations of your teachers and neighbors and parents that you will be successful and have everything you need to do the basics. Graduate from high school, go to college, land a job, start a healthy family with the great circumstances in your favor. Still very true for upper middle class America all over the country where the American dream is alive. It works better than anywhere in the world. And in these same cities where that happens, there are neighborhoods where you only see the American dream on TV. Accomplishing those four basic things is an uphill battle that most of our children are not achieving consistently. So for us, that's the end game is how do we change the way we pour into neighborhoods so that the family who wants to succeed can succeed and feels enabled to do that. And it's not like this endless, you know, game of chance. If you don't want to succeed, it's still America. You're free to screw up your life if you want to. That option's available to everyone all the time.
Okay. Well, I could dig deep into what you do and all this stuff. So we're going to save that for another time. Want to dig a little more into just you personally. So when did you realize the power of capital?
You know, I told you a bit about my upbringing and my love of business and this idea that business has a greater purpose than making profits, right? That its legacy is in the character of its people and that work has more meaning than just making money from a faith perspective, because the ability to provide work, to engage people in employment, is a chance for their character to be shaped and revealed, and in that the image of our maker is made. But capital, as in our ability to amass assets, money, resources, and the tendency to see that as not a sort of a fortunate set of circumstances that should fill our hearts with gratitude, and the kind of weight of responsibility that comes with sincere gratitude. Like when you feel genuinely lucky, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I have this. There is a more natural inclination to want to share. But there is an attitude in most humans that when we find ourselves feeling comfortable in the collection of any asset, of any resource, a box of toys or money in an account, you start to believe that it is both yours and that you've earned it and that you've deserved it. And so that entitlement that comes with capital oftentimes robs people of the gift of capital. The gift of capital is to see it be put to work to create opportunities for others. And for all of our human history, capital has both played the role of being the fuel of progress and of great good in the world, and the cancer of societies, where because people don't understand that it is an incredible engine for good, it starts to corrode the hearts of those who have the most of it many times, and often engage in the kinds of activities based out of protection and hoarding that create both great poverty and great disruption into civil life. So I think I've been growing more and more. This work has also opened my eyes to the power of capital in all of its forms. Whether it's public resources, philanthropy, the role of corporations, private finance. And so it's critical today. I think we'd all do better to grow smarter about it, for sure.
So I think you alluded to this earlier on, and then in your answer, you almost alluded to this. And this is a very broad question. How do you view stewardship?
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those like Sunday morning words that people don't use very often unless you've kind of grown up in a faith context maybe. But the notion of stewardship, the idea that you are entrusted something and you are held accountable for how you use it, but it's never really yours. But you need to use it, handle it, think about it with the same intentionality as if it was yours, and at the same time have open hands about it. Is hard for most people. I think even those who believe they understand the concept and live by the concept, it's hard to practice. Peter Block wrote a book many years ago by the title Stewardship, and it was basically a management philosophy theory that talked about the idea of the paternalistic posture of most corporations to just dictate to people what to do was not only not conducive to motivating a workforce, but counterproductive to innovation and to the kind of insight of what works on the front lines that you need to compete today. And that what you really wanted, needed to compete in the future, was to move beyond paternalism towards partnership. That people believe that you're a steward of this mission, I'm a steward of this mission, we're in this mission together. And I think there's a level of stewardship that goes beyond just saying like, hey, I have this, I want to be a good steward of it, i.e. I want to make good choices that are responsible and right for the common good. But I also want to engage in the use of these resources with an awareness I can't and shouldn't figure this all out by myself, that I need the input and the resources and the capital of others. This is where this comes up for me on a regular basis. In our work, everything we set out to do, someone tells us is impossible. You can't build that quality housing there. You can't build that level, an early learning center there. And the only way to pull off impossible things is to not try to do it by the limitation of your resources. And so I'm constantly challenging municipalities or foundations or private individuals and corporations. Dreams that are big enough, they require you needing other people to be part of the puzzle. And there's a stewardship that goes beyond what are you doing with what you have, but goes into what are you doing with what you don't have? In other words, your shortfalls, your shortcomings, the things you can't solve for, those are invitations for the resources of other people, the imaginations, gifts, and talents of others. And so to me, there's a like stewardship and its basic understanding is hard enough for us to grasp. But I think there's a next level invitation of stewarding a sense of responsibility for the problems of our world, whether you cause them or not, there's a mess, clean it up. Do what you can to make the situation better. And as you engage in it, it's never all on you. It doesn't have to be. Share the responsibility for those problems with others. And you'd be amazed. I mean, we've got huge challenges in our world today, and they can feel insurmountable and unfixable. We can fix them, but none of us can do it alone.
Well, it just reminds me, sitting where we're sitting today, because I do remember Lyft Orlando, what was it, 7-8 years ago to start?
Just an idea, yeah.
Yeah, just an idea. And to see driving in here today, see the development, see the assisted living. Is it assisted living?
No, it's senior living.
Senior living. And then, of course, this multifamily right here, which is mixed use. It is a great testament to dream and, frankly, think outside of the traditional parameters. So you mentioned the word dream. Do you have a dream personally that you would love to see come to fruition in your lifetime?
I shared a little bit about this before we started. So in my journey, you can hear, I have a sense of, I can personally identify with the need and stress and pressures of some of our most vulnerable families in our city. That compels to a sense of impact for them. But for whatever reason, my career path has been full of also witnessing the misery and loneliness and isolation that comes for those that might be blessed with power and resources and notoriety, but not with a deep sense of meaning for what to do with that and the significance that comes through service and contribution. And so I have an equal passion for seeing that, for seeing people moved by compassion to want to make a difference and leverage what they have for that, because I know it actually makes them richer. It doesn't make them poor. But oftentimes in our world today, how to get capital and the resources of the few that have most of it to be seen showing up in the lives of those who have the least is almost always only interpreted as the mechanism of big, large, heavy governments filling that gap and becoming that conduit. And yet I don't have a blind faith in government either. You know, I think we're all corrupt. Whatever type name badge you're wearing, we're capable of sin and sinful choices. And so plenty of good and not so much good has come from those type of strategies. So the dream, the crazy idea, if I could wave a wand and change something about the way the world works, is a structure that incentivized corporations taking really, really good care of their people. That the tax incentives, write-offs, credits, and opportunities for companies to keep more capital would be tied to their performance in making sure that every employee, particularly those making the least, are making more and more every year, are living in better conditions, are finding their kids gaining access to great education. And that as companies would care for their communities and care for their people, governments would see the opportunity to offload the responsibility of what would be a long pipeline of needy folks to the stewardship of corporations. And how you do that, there are layers of reasons why it would or would not work. But the notion of people who hold capital and create capital feeling tied, feeling tethered to specific communities and specific people, that's something we've lost a long time ago. And I think if there were creative ways to bring it back, we'd be better for it.
Well, in the space that I find myself, which there's some similarities to what you do, the encouraging thing is we do see some positive movement in there, all the way from social impact bonds to opportunity zones. Mm-hmm. And while maybe these aren't perfect, these weren't in existence 10, 15 years ago.
No.
So it is encouraging in that regard.
I agree with you 100%. I think you and I've been inspired in our conversations to consider that. When you look at what's happening in philanthropy, there's a confluence occurring between the extremes of profit motivation, motivated business, and pure charity fueled philanthropy, and finding ways to bring the kind of rigor, bottom line thinking, and innovation of the typical business world and the heart for impact and the seriousness of measuring impact from the philanthropic world that I think we'll see more and more things, from PRIs being leveraged by foundations to social impact investments and everything in between. That future where we find ourselves understanding our connection to each other, I don't think it's as distant as we might imagine.
All right. So the last question I have for you is, do you have a story that is from probably this community that motivates you, keeps you going on a day-to-day basis?
There are so many. There's one in particular. You know, when we started, there were people we met who dared to trust enough to just keep showing up in the conversation. And one woman in particular, Mrs. Bassa, was just kind of a sweet soul who was a spiritual giant. And, you know, she would tell you about some adversity her or a child were going through, and in the same breath tell you how glad she was to be alive and how much she loved the Lord. And it was just every interaction with her was sort of, it would fuel me with a sense of both grit and positive expectation for the future. And when we acquired the property where Pendana is now, one of the trees on the site had a little sign, a white sign, about 12 inches wide, 2-3 inches tall, with a red border, and it just had one word, Jesus. And then at the other end of the site, at the other end of the street, there was another tree with the same thing. And years later, when we, through a lot of effort, were able to acquire the site for the Early Learning Center, I showed up during the demo and I found one of the trees with that same sign. Mm. And what occurred to me is, you know, we get written up in the paper over stuff coming out of the ground and things that we build and, you know, numbers with a lot of zeros in them because of these projects are expensive and complicated. But really, this community, there have been great things happening here, people believing in better things and a brighter future long before we showed up. And today, I mean, I was just, Tim and the effort of residents, they, I mean, so over 100,000 pounds of food have been distributed in these biweekly distributions, helping families. Some don't even have the means to come and get the food, and their neighbors are picking it up and taking it to them. And so it's the life of this community that far preceded us showing up. And our hope is that one day when they talk about what happened here, they describe what their auntie and grandpa and neighbor did. And if Lift Orlando gets mentioned as how the community around them was part of that, the greater goal is that they feel they own the change that happened here, because that means they'll own the future that comes as well.
Well, we very much appreciate your time. And
thank you, man.
We could talk for hours, and maybe we'll have you back on. And obviously great things are happening here, so we'll get an update at some point. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast of choice. And please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.